I'm Dan Cassidy, and this is UBS On Air's Washington Weekly Podcast. Each week, we do like to touch base with the UBS U.S. Office of Public Policy and discuss the latest on developments within the Beltway and beyond. Today, we will touch on Election Day outcomes and implications, the presidential campaign trail, developments up on Capitol Hill, and a whole lot more. And joining me again for the podcast, glad to welcome back Shane Lieberman from the UBS U.S. Office of Public Policy down in Washington, D.C. So, Shane, welcome back, and thank you for joining us this week.
Great to be with you as always, Dan.
So, Shane, I know we did have Election Day here in the U.S. on Tuesday. Can you recap for us some of the notable races and the outcomes?
Absolutely. This past Tuesday featured a number of elections around the country, including gubernatorial races in Kentucky and Mississippi. In Kentucky, the Democrat won, and in Mississippi, the Republican won, as well as important state legislature races in New Jersey and Virginia. In New Jersey, Republicans actually picked up a handful of seats, and in Virginia, Democrats were able to take control of both the state House and state Senate. And, you know, this is noteworthy for two reasons. First, overall, Republican candidates fared poorly in suburban areas. And this is a continued trend that started a few years ago and was prevalent in 2018 midterm elections. One of President Trump's greatest re-election challenges will be to neutralize this trend. Second is that voter turnout this week was very high from both the Democratic base and Republican base voters. Notably, Kentucky experienced its highest turnout in the past three decades, while turnout in Virginia was up there with 2017 elections, which also featured statewide races. So this is very noteworthy. I think Republicans are concerned about some of this turnout in the suburbs and the trend in the suburbs. But, you know, they have some shades of positive on their side. Like I mentioned, they gained some state seats in New Jersey. I think the Virginia takeover by Democrats is also noteworthy in the prism and context of we have redistricting coming up in the next few years, where the state on the state level, the districts for the House of Representatives will be redrawn, and Democrats controlling the process in Virginia bodes well for Democrats favorably drawing lines in their favor to keep more Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives.
So, Shane, diving a bit deeper into the implications of these outcomes, and given, as you mentioned, the types of turnouts we witnessed, the trends we're witnessing in suburban America, what are the implications, the takeaways for both Republicans and Democrats, especially for accounting that 2020 is right around the corner?
Yeah, I think, you know, both sides need to understand what happened. I think there's that initial reaction, like in the Kentucky governor's race, where Democrats took the governor's seat, and they're very excited about this, as they should be. But they shouldn't see it as a national trend or a larger trend in Kentucky, where they'll be able to defeat Mitch McConnell in the Senate race next year. This was really the implication here was that it was a flawed candidate on the Republican side. It was a governor who, sitting Republican governor, who was one of the most unpopular governors in the country. And I would also note that he is still fighting the results of the election. So on this side, you know, you have to understand the results and put in a better game plan. This helps you understand where your weaknesses may be for 2020. And also, you need to understand it so you don't overreact and think, get ahead of yourself. So Democrats need to recognize their strengths in the suburbs and focus there. And Republicans need to recognize that that is a weakness and focus on ways to improve there, but also recognize that flawed candidates matter and good candidates matter. And they need to put an emphasis on recruiting on the lower levels where you have challengers who could potentially win back seats. You need standout candidates to make that a possibility.
Turning to Decision 2020 for a moment, I know, Shane, since we last spoke, the Democratic field has narrowed a bit, yet as of this morning, it might have expanded as well. What can you share with us on that front?
Yeah, most notably, we saw Beto O'Rourke, former congressman from Texas, drop out of the race. I think we saw this coming. He was not a flawed candidate by any means on the larger level. You know, he had flaws like we all do. But I think he got a little ahead of himself by doing so well in the Senate Texas race that people pushed him, and he thought he had a good chance when I think the reality was is that he was going to be overshadowed and was overshadowed. I think he does have a bright future if he wants to remain in politics. He just needs to figure out what that path is. But I think you're right. The bigger story right now is Mayor Mike Bloomberg looking to get into the presidential race. I think his calculation at this moment is that he believes former Vice President Biden is starting a downward trend, and that leaves open the door and the opportunity for a moderate Democrat and to grab all those moderate Democrats, especially in swing states, and get their support. I think that remains to be seen. Vice President Biden is not doing as well as he should be at the moment, but he's not dead man walking by any means. So I think this will be interesting to play out. I would note that the next Democrat debate is Wednesday night, so everyone circle their calendars. I believe this debate will be 2 hours, unlike last debate, which was 3 hours, which I think Democrats realized was a bit too long to hold the attention of potential voters.
Okay, well, that sounds like it won't go past my bedtime, so that's something I'll look forward to next week, and I'm sure we'll talk about that and get some takeaways from next week's debate. I do want to follow up, Shane, on our ongoing conversation on impeachment. I know we had some additional congressional testimonies which occurred this week. We had a notable no-show, but who did we hear from, and where do we currently stand with this story?
Yeah, as you noted, no-shows, I think, were a bigger story than who showed up, but and we talked about this last week, Mulvaney, who's the White House Chief of Staff, his senior advisor, Robert Blair, refused to testify, as did National Security Council lawyers John Eisenberg and Michael Ellis and Brian McCormick. The notable person to testify was Jennifer Williams, who is Vice President Pence's special advisor for Europe and Russia. She was actually on the call that is the nexus of all this, the call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. I think her main takeaway was she was surprised that politics was brought up on this call. I think the other noteworthy parts is that the House Intelligence Committee is subpoenaing Chief of Staff Mulvaney, and also next week we expect the impeachment hearing is to go public. And that phase, will garner obviously a lot of attention with open hearings. I think Democrats hope to bolster their case for impeachment, though we don't anticipate any new bombshells or much new information to be revealed in these sessions. It's just that it brings it more in the light and helps Democrats beat back the accusation that all this is happening in secret.
Okay, so next week can be interesting with these public hearings commencing. I do want to stick with Capitol Hill for a moment. I know, Shane, we've been hearing some rumblings as of late about a potential government shutdown. Where exactly do we currently stand with a funding bill?
Yes, government operations is funded through November 21st, so just under 2 weeks from now. Negotiations are not going well. They're not going terribly at this point, but we're under a short time frame for members of Congress and the White House to come up with an agreement to fund government operations. I think the most likely scenario at this point is some kind of short-term punt where they fund government operations into December. You cannot rule out the possibility of a shutdown. If there were a shutdown, you know, it could be a few days. It could be through the Thanksgiving holiday and resolved in December. There is absolutely a possibility that they come to a resolution and fund government operations, you know, for the remainder of the fiscal year, which would be through September 30th, 2020. But I think that's on the lower end of the probabilities scale. You know, so we're looking for Congress to come together probably and do a short-term punt and then eventually agree to a longer-term solution.
Okay, well, hopefully they come to a deal sooner rather than later, but we'll continue to keep our eyes open for any developments on this front. One final point, it would not be a Washington Weekly podcast if we did not spend at least a few moments discussing trade. So specific to U.S. and China, trade negotiations have been continuing. They've taken a more positive direction this week, and that's evident by how the markets have been responding. What's the latest on that front?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're right that the markets definitely noticed positive developments in the U.S.-China trade saga, we'll call it. Progress continued this week, and it appears that both countries are very close to agreeing to specific provisions relating to large Chinese purchases of U.S. agriculture, currency protections, additional market opening measures, modest intellectual property protections, and a reduction of some higher U.S. tariffs. Additionally, higher U.S. tariffs on Chinese consumer goods planned for December 15th will likely be delayed. So this phase one agreement, if it's finalized, will be very modest in the view of more comprehensive measures, but it appears to be on a good track. The final deal is not in place, but I think what we're getting very close to having this phase one deal completed. But we shouldn't overlook that there'll be more turbulence likely ahead next year as, you know, there are discussions about phase two, three, or a final deal. And that will bring some turbulence, as I've said. And, you know, but, you know, I think both sides are celebrating and anxious to get phase one signed and sealed and delivered.
Okay, well, Shane, as always, appreciate you dropping by and keeping our listeners informed on a variety of timely topics. So we'll look forward to catching back up again with you next week and hope you have a nice weekend.
Thanks, you too, Dan. Everyone have a great weekend.
Thank you, Shane. And again, we have been joined by Shane Lieberman from the UBS U.S. Office of Public Policy in Washington, D.C. For our listeners, do be sure to reference the most recent edition of the Washington Weekly publication, which can now be located up on UBS Online Services. As always, if you are a client of UBS, just reach out to your financial advisor, and they can provide you with a copy of the Washington Weekly publication directly. From the UBS On Air studios in New York City, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers both investment advisory services and brokerage services, which are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and governed by different laws and separate contracts. For more information, visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. All rights reserved. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA SIPC.